Okay, it was approximately 3 a.m. When I got a phone call, woke me up from my boss, Lieutenant John Rogers, and he simply said that you have a double. That means we have a double homicide. He said it was in the West L.A. area. I've been doing this for a number of years. I'm kind of used to it. We don't ask a lot of questions in that initial call. We just get an address and we respond, and so that's what happened here. I got the address in West LA, and I got up, got dressed, and I was out the door probably in less than 15 minutes. Usually grab something to eat on the way, an apple or something else, piece of fruit, coffee if I have time. And I got on the freeway and went down to the over the West LA area to the address given to me on Bundy Drive. Okay, I was not all that familiar with the West LA area. That particular area doesn't have a whole lot of crime. And to get a double homicide there was kind of unusual. But I pulled up near the front of Bundy, and the officers that first arrived had the scene secured. They had Bundy blocked off. They had the rear alley behind the location blocked off. They had extended out the crime scene, which was good. At a crime scene, you want as much, take as much space as you can get, because you don't really know how much you're going to have that's involved with the crime initially, so you want as much as you can get. The concern became Bundy Drive is the main thoroughfare between San Vicente and Wilshire Boulevard, and we were concerned with Bundy morning traffic because it was very busy during the weekdays, people coming and going to work and whatnot. So we knew that in 2 to 3 hours, we would either have to open up Bundy or keep it closed. If we kept it closed, then people would know something was going on that would attract the media. The last thing you want at a crime scene investigation is to be mobbed by media, especially with a double homicide. It's going to interfere with you one way or the other, sooner or later. So we had to make a decision whether or not to open up Bundy, as well as the alley behind the location, because of the traffic concerns. I had parked my car and was met there by the West LA homicide detectives, and my partner, Phil Vanetta, had also arrived earlier. I was given a brief rundown on what was going on. In fact, the two people apparently had been knifed to death. They were lying in the front of the location on Bundy. One was either the estranged or current wife of O.J. Simpson. The other man was unidentified. I was given a walkthrough, which is normally what happens at a crime scene when the investigator is going to take over the case shows up. He's given this little oral debriefing and then given a brief walkthrough. Well, the walkthrough would include being directed to evidence as well as the bodies at a crime scene and basically what they have to that date, to that moment in time. At a crime scene, bodies are evidence also. Sometimes it's a little hard for people to understand that. The people who are murdered are now, unfortunately, they are no longer people. Right? They're considered evidence, and so you have to treat them as such. We were given this, my partner and I were given this walkthrough with the West LA detectives, and different things were pointed out to us. A blood trail was observed adjacent to bloody footwear impressions, appeared to be blood in the footwear impressions, leading from the bodies off to the west, up the stairs, past the front open door of the location, which was well lit inside. The footwear impressions went to the walkway all the way to the alley, to the rear. And it went through a gate that emptied out onto the alleyway in the back. There were obviously things of evidentiary value in addition to the blood around the bodies. We saw an envelope, a white envelope, that appeared to have a pair of prescription glasses in it between the two bodies. There was a pager near the male victim. Blood was splattered in all different directions. There was a blue Navy knit cap on the ground right near the envelope. There was also a glove, a left-handed leather glove lying on the ground between the two bodies. So what you do is you take this in and then decide what you're going to do as far as handling this particular crime scene investigation. The first problem again was securing the crime scene. If we had left the crime scene secured in Bundy Drive, secured again, we would have a lot of unwanted attention. So we opened up part of that briefly after the sun had come up. In the meantime, the word had gotten out and the press was starting to show up, and they were actually setting up their cameras across the street on the east side of Bundy on a little hill that overlooked down on top of the crime scene. And it was like 115 feet away, a little too close for comfort. You don't want evidence at a crime scene photographed by the media or anyone else before you find out what you have and before you can do anything with it. It could compromise your investigation. That became a concern. Coroner was given what we call a first call. We said what we had, it's going to be a media situation, so prepare for this. In other words, when we call you the second time, you'll know what we have and how to roll on it. Because the coroner, when they arrive at a murder scene, they actually conduct their own investigation independent of ours also, with us in attendance. So you have the police doing their investigation, the coroner doing their investigation. Their investigation primarily involves the bodies and anything that's on the bodies, any evidence that may be on the bodies, any weapons that may be under the bodies or hold on to by one of the victims. This is the coroner's responsibility. But we knew from the get-go that we were going to be there a while, so security became paramount. We were shortly informed that the woman who had been killed, and she was nearly decapitated when I looked at her, a vicious killing, there were other slash wounds. It looked to be something personal. This was just not a narcotics deal gone wrong. This was not a situation where someone was being robbed. This happened rather late on a Sunday night. We wanted to look for witnesses first. So we had already sent some people door knocking around the neighborhood to see if we could find any of that. But we were also informed that O.J. Simpson himself was, again, either married to or estranged from the woman. And we wanted him to be notified. And we were told that he only lived a couple, 3 miles from the location. Come to find out, it was only 2 miles away as a crow flies. There was a commander at the scene who made a decision that he should be contacted as soon as possible, because I was also informed that there were two young children who were removed from upstairs by the responding officers once the house had been cleared. And they were now at the West Los Angeles station. They were very young children. We needed to contact him or a family member to tell them that what had occurred and to take care of the kids, frankly. So the commander had suggested that we go up. Didn't suggest, he actually ordered us to go up with the two other detectives to try to locate O.J. Simpson at his Rockingham estate, which again was just 2 miles away. At this time, traffic was starting to build. The media was setting up more cameras. We knew that the media has a lot of contacts. They have a lot of people they can control. They have a lot of information they can obtain that as far as victims go and as far as victims' relatives go. So we had to assume that they would probably know who O.J. Simpson was. So we wanted to get to Rockingham first to contact him and let him know what was going on. And as far as his children, we had his children in custody at the station. And the woman there, again, was either estranged or related to him in some fashion. So we left for Rockingham. We had two cars. Van Adder and I were in one car. Furman and his supervisor, Ron Phillips, were in the other car. The plan was to contact Simpson and leave Furman and Phillips with Simpson, assist him, make the death notification, assist him in getting his children back, stay with him, because obviously he would be very upset when he found out what had occurred, especially to his estranged wife, or maybe they were still married, we didn't know, and the children. So the one unit would stay with them. Meanwhile, Phil and I would return to the crime scene and conduct a crime scene investigation. There were two cars in the driveway. There was a light on, appeared to be one light on inside. And the gates were secured. The Rockingham gate was secured. There is a white Bronco parked outside the Rockingham gate, parked up over the curb, that is not normally used for parking cars, it would look like, because of the curbing and everything else. And again, it's a very narrow street. Rockingham is narrow. Driving up the street, cars parked slightly askew. As if someone who parked it there might have been in a hurry, supposition to say they were. While we're looking at the Bronco, there's a white wooden stick. I find it's in the parkway by the Bronco. It looks like it's fresh, a freshly cut piece of wood, but it looks like perhaps from a fence. It's I think it's like 2 inches by 3 inches, it's square and white on one side, but it's broken off and the brake is fresh. And it doesn't belong there. Obviously, as we look for it, a crime scene, something that's out of place. We noted a second gate around the corner on Ashford Street called the Ashford Gate. It too was locked and secured. There was a phone by that gate that went into the inside of the residence. We had picked up the phone, tried to notify someone inside and got no response. And it's now about 5:15 in the morning. With two cars in the driveway, a light on inside, no one responding to our calls in the inside. We notified the local security who came by shortly thereafter and we asked them if they knew about anybody inside. They were aware that O.J. Simpson lived there and they had no further information as far as contact numbers or anything else. So we had to get inside to see to make this notification. I became alerted that this is 2 miles from a very bloody crime scene. There should be somebody here with these cars. We felt there's a strong possibility that there may be problems here. This also may be an extension of the crime scene. We may have more victims. We don't know. These are exigent circumstances, as the law would describe them. You have to make a decision. Okay, you can go to breakfast maybe, you can go back to the scene. No, you don't do any of that nonsense. You have an exigent circumstance, you've got to get into the house. Furman was standing by the wall. It's a large wall. I think it was like 15 inches thick, 5 feet tall. He crawled over the wall and he opened the Ashford gate to let us in. At that point, the four of us went to the front door, banged on the door. We got no response. There was more concern about someone inside, that there may have been a problem. We went around to the rear of the location, and the rear was secured. There was a glass door that was locked. We banged on the door, and we got no response. We noticed 2 rooms off to the back attached from the home, like 2 little extra bedrooms. Knocked on the first one, and it was answered by Arnell Simpson, who turns out to be O.J. Simpson's daughter. And a young man, a blonde-haired, long-haired man, came to the second one. That was Cato Kalin. We had woken both of them up in their separate locations, identified ourselves, and we said we wanted to know where her dad was. Her first comment to me was, well, isn't he in the house? When she said that, after we identified ourselves, I became really concerned because if he's in the house, there's a problem. He may be another victim. So I said, well, we don't know because no one's responding. Do you have a key to the rear to get in? And she said, yes, I'll get the key. What's going on? She became very concerned, obviously so, with four cops knocking on the door at 5:30 in the morning, asking about her dad. I also asked, should there been anybody in there? And she said, well, just my dad was probably there. But unbeknownst to us, Furman was talking to Cato Kalin. Cato Kalin had told him that Simpson was actually on a plane on his way to Chicago early the night before. So we went to the door, she unlocked it, and she's becoming now almost frantic, wanting to know what's going on. I had to calm her down, and I said, there's been a problem that Nicole, do you know Nicole? We'd identified Nicole at that time. Nicole Simpson, Nicole Brown Simpson. Yes, what's wrong? I said, well, she died. Arnell became very upset. She started screaming. She wanted to get inside the house. I said, no, let us go in. And I said, this is to myself and my partner, this could get really bad. So kept her out and opened the door and I went inside not knowing what we'd find. We also were informed that there was a housekeeper that stayed there and had her own room. I asked her now where the room was. She told me it's in and off to the left. So I went in and everything looked fine. And I went to the maid's room. It was fine. The bed was made. Everything was in place. There was nothing disturbed. And so I went back out and I said, what's going on with your dad? And at that time, Cato had come out and said that, oh, by the way, he's in Chicago to Arnell. Apparently she either forgot that he was in Chicago or wasn't aware of it. Again, we woke her up from the dead sleep. Maybe she didn't understand what we wanted. That was taken care of. And we were told that the housekeeper took the night off Sunday night, so she wasn't there. Everything was fine in the house. We explained what was going on and went inside the house. Cato was becoming concerned. He wanted to know what was going on. We told him that there'd been a problem. We explained to him that Nicole had been killed without any other details. We went inside the house and right away, Arnell wanted to call A.C. Cowlings, who was like a brother to her. He was very close with O.J., very close to the family. So she wanted him there. And I said, fine, call him. Meanwhile, Phillips got on the phone, and after we found out where Simpson was in Chicago, Phillips called Chicago and got Simpson on the phone, explained to him that there's been a problem at home without giving him any details. He said, okay, fine, I'll be on the next plane coming back. And that's about all he said. At this point, it struck me kind of strange that there had been someone killed and his kids were there when this happened. And he never asked about his kids. He never came excited about anything other than to say, I'll be on the next plane to LA. We went back and were talking to Arnell and Cato a bit more. We had to make a decision about what to do with the family. And I wanted to talk to Simpson to see what plane he was on. And this became a little more concerning when I made a death notification to the Brown family. Now, I'd gotten that information from Arnell. The worst thing a cop wants to do is make a death notification. But that's part of the job. You have to sometimes. Is the way to make it over the phone? No. You never want to make a death notification over the phone. You want to do it in person. I can't think of anything more impersonal than to do something like that over the phone. However, we now have the media involved, which is a problem. They're going to find out about the Brown family and where they live, and they're going to do something about it. They're going to be there before us. That's the last thing an investigator wants, is for them to talk about the family without talking to us first. We do not want that. Therefore, I had to make a decision. We had to make this death notification over the phone. I didn't want to do it. I had no other choice. So I got a hold of the Browns, and I talked to Lou Brown, Nicole's dad, first. And unbeknownst to me, Denise, Nicole's sister, was on an extension phone call on listening to my conversation, probably wanting to know what was going on so early on a Monday morning. So I said, well, Nicole looks like she's been killed. We don't have any details at this point, and we're trying to notify the family. I'm sorry to have to tell you that she died, and we need to make that notification now. We're trying to get a hold of Mr. Simpson. All of a sudden, I hear all the screaming on the extension. Well, it's Denise. And she starts screaming about, he did it, that MF, he killed her. I know he killed her. Simpson, he killed her. And so I'm hearing all of this noise in the background. She's totally distressed. Tried to calm them down over the phone. I gave them my name, number, and any information. I said, we'll get back to you just as soon as we can. The media is already onto this. They're going to try to contact you. You can do what you want, but please don't talk to them before we get back to you. This is a situation now that's growing by the minute. Simpson says he's on his way back. We're going to have to wait him for him, wait here at the house for him. And again, please don't share this with anybody at this point. So we cut the conversation with them. Right after that happened, Simpson called back and I answered and I talked to him. He said he got a flight and he's on his way back. I said, good. We can meet you at the airport. He says, don't bother. A friend of mine will pick me up. I says, okay, we'd like to see you back at Rockingham. He says, I'll be there. I'll get picked up. I'll see you at Rockingham. Again, I didn't get into any details. He didn't ask about any details. If it's me and I have my kids at a house where two people were murdered, I would be real concerned about my kids. He never mentioned them. It was like, it was just a normal phone call. Okay, I'll be on the next flight. And that was it. Went outside, and as soon as I got off the phone, my partner came up to me and he said, Furman talked to Cato. Cato mentioned something about an earthquake or a big thud on the wall behind his bed. And so Furman went out to check it out, find out what was going on back there. And Furman found a leather glove that looks just like the leather glove we have at Rocky at the crime scene. My first question was, well, is it a right-hand glove or a left-hand glove? They said, well, it looks like a right-hand glove. They didn't get too close to the glove. Now, the glove, I went back, he said, take a look. So I went out. They showed me the glove. I didn't get too close. I was maybe 10 feet away, but it did look like a right-handed glove. It did look like the same type of glove. Now, the glove was located in a very narrow walkway that was dark. Now, the sun was beginning to come up, and that was why the glove was being able to see when Furman went back to check out what the so-called noise was. It looked like it was below a large, older outdoor air conditioning unit that was attached to the rear of Cato's bungalow. It stuck out, and anyone who wanted to go to the rear of this walkway would have had to go around this air conditioning unit and probably would have knocked into it, because I said there was no lights back there at all. It was old and it was stuck up, blocking probably two-thirds of the walkway, which was narrow anyway. And beyond that was a fence. So anybody that wanted to go beyond that air conditioning would have had to walk very carefully around the air conditioning unit and go to the rear. So staying with this narrow walkway for just a few seconds, it extended to the rear of the three connected bungalows. And I walked back there. As I walked back there, I went through cobwebs and everything else. Obviously, this walkway wasn't used too often by anybody. But when I got to the rear, there was an open, vacant area, probably maybe 30 by 40 feet. And back there was nothing but junk. There was an old wheelbarrow, old tools, old tires. It looked like the residents were using that area just to throw junk away. until they got to a point where they were tired of throwing junk away and I guess would remove it. But this was a place where everything was just abandoned. Then in the back of my mind, why would someone be back there? And now we have a glove beneath the air conditioning unit. We walked out, we did a little bit of talking, and again, the sun was coming up. My partner's out in the front driveway, and he sees what looks to be a trail of blood coming from the Rockingham Gate up towards the front door. And these things are building in your mind. Glove, blood, gate, car. What is it doing at it? Why isn't it in the driveway with the other cars? This isn't evidence of anything, but it builds in your mind. These are things that you observe. Herman sees what appears to be a tiny speck of blood. Now, we don't know if it's blood or not, but it appears to be what is blood. Now, the driver's side of the Bronco, the door opens out and towards the front. You have to open that with your left hand. You could open it, technically, with your right hand, but if you do that, You're way over here and you're opening the door into yourself. It doesn't make any sense. Irrespective of whether you're a left-handed person or a right-handed person, you are going to open that door with your left hand. Again, one of those little things you stick in the back of your mind. We got a, looks like a speck of blood there. Now we have blood tailing. When I say tailing, a blood droplet, when it strikes the surface, will tail in the direction of travel of the source. If it hits, it's going to splatter and it's going to parallel out where the tail will be to the front towards the direction that the source is going. That's what I mean by tailing. It was tailing from the general area of the rear of the Bronco up the driveway and into the house. Okay, we've got the blood speck, we've got the glove, we've got the blood tailing, the Bronco. We have another crime scene or an extension of the previous crime scene. At this point, we have to stop what we're doing and decide what to do. Well, obvious thing for us, we've done a few of these, you need a warrant, you need a search warrant. We can't go any further without, and we're not gonna have a problem getting a search warrant. So we declare the Rockingham house a crime scene. I tell Arnell and AC, who has just shown up, that they're gonna have to leave as well, Cato, because it's a crime scene. We suggest they go to the police station because we're going to have to talk to them also eventually. And we have the kids there. They can reunite with the kids. Simpson is en route. We have a crime scene in Rockingham. We've secured Rockingham. It's going to take a while to get a warrant because in order to get a warrant under these circumstances, you're going to have to go through the district attorney's office. Get a DA involved if you can. At this point, it's obvious in our minds, we have a high profile situation. It's gonna be a lot of media because there's celebrity involved. Whether or not O.J. Simpson is a suspect is unknown. We have questions for him, obviously, as the spouse or former spouse or whatever. We're gonna have questions for anybody in the family. We're gonna interview everybody probably more than a couple of times. He's not a suspect at this point. But Rockingham is a crime scene. We have to get a warrant. So Phil will go in, Van Adder, my partner, meet up with the district attorney's office, put the case together for that DA. We'll have to seek out a judge, get the judge to approve the warrant. We'll have to return to the location before we can do anything with that evidence that we've seen and before we can search the house, because we fully intend to thoroughly search the house. Phil has been working with a DA by the name of Clark, Marcia Clark. Well, I knew Marcia because I had worked with her on a couple of cases. In fact, we currently had a case, an organized crime case, a murder for hire case, that she had just refused after working it for a year to file. But that's another matter. But I had a problem with her on that other case. Phil and her had handled murder cases together. In fact, they handled the first no-body DNA case in the state of California, and she did an excellent job, and they got a conviction on a no-body DNA case. She was known to be a very hard-nosed prosecutor, very bright, but I had a personal thing because she had pulled the rug out from under a case. that I was involved in. My concern now is this particular case. We got to do something. So I told Phil that I would rather not have her. And I'm now back at Bundy. I've got to get back there to conduct this crime scene investigation. The bodies are still there. The media is building up over there. The coroner's got to roll on this. I got to get back. We don't have time to mess around with this. So I said, okay, fine, go with Marcia. So Phil takes off, gonna find Marcia. He's gonna get the warrant. I return to the Bundy location where I commence the crime scene investigation. And I'm there for several hours, obviously doing that. And the coroner's office shows up. One thing leads to another. We go through all the motions of the crime scene investigation. I've got a criminalist there, two criminalists are there. I've got photographers there. I've got print people. I've got four latent print people working. They're starting to get prints on the exterior. We want the interior of the house also looked at, although there's no evidence that the suspect went into the home. Both bodies are outside on the walkway by the front gate of the Bundy location, although the front door is wide open. I go inside and there's no evidence of any wrongdoing or any crime scene or blood or anything else inside. It's apparent that the victim did everything, were outside when they were attacked, and that the suspect walked directly by the front door. Now, of some interest, just beyond the front door and towards the rear gate, where the bloody footprint impressions go, they stop. And whoever left the footwear impressions turns around, because you can see the footwear impressions turning around, back towards the bodies, and they're looking back down towards the body, and then they would turn around and continue walking. And again, we did a heel-toe analysis. Whoever was walking, they were walking, they weren't running. So whoever committed this crime, the suspect, did not run from the scene, they walked. Why would they stop and look back? Well, again, back at the scene, we not only have the bodies, but we have the glove, the cap, the knit cap. Did the suspect become aware that, hey, you know, I lost my glove, I lost my cap, should I go back or not? Well, they decided not to. Suspect continued on towards the rear through the rear gate, leaving a blood trail to his left. Again, one of the little things you put in the back of your mind, we have a blood trail on the left side of the footwear impressions that the source left. Again, tailing in conjunction with the footwear impressions, all tailing back towards the alley. There are five, six blood droplets tailing in that same direction. It's going to take some time before we can analyze all of this blood. So we know we're going to ask for blood, not just from the victims, but from anybody else who may be suspected as a possible suspect. Eventually, this will include O.J. Simpson. On the other side of the gate, I see two coins. I think it was a dime and a penny. Next, they're a concentric around blood droplet. So I'm thinking that particular last blood droplet came from a source straight down. That source was not moving. However, the five blood droplets prior were moving, tailing towards, through the gate, towards this one droplet. It was concentric. Right next to the dime and the penny. I believe it's a dime and a penny. So what does this mean? Well, again, you put that in the back of your mind. Could someone have been going into their pocket looking for their keys to their car because they may have left that way? That's where the bloody footwear impressions go. And inadvertently dropped a couple of coins. And is that when this last blood droplet was left? Because the source was not moving when that blood droplet hit the ground. Is this what had happened? We don't know. So we take photographs of all of this stuff. Inside the house, we find that there's a large butcher knife on the counter, kitchen counter. There's no apparent blood on it. We print it. There's no tape. There's no prints on it. There's no latent prints on it. There's no debris on it. No nothing. It's just lying on the counter. Question, what is that doing there? Did someone hear something, took out the knife, perhaps in defense of themselves? We don't know. I go upstairs where the kids were. There's a large tub bath of water that's been drawn. There's candles lit all the way around the bathtub, and the tub is full. Was the victim intending on taking a bath? Was she drawn away from it because she's wearing a kind of a mini skirt, a shift, no shoes? Did someone come to her door? And was she waiting for someone, and had she already drawn the bath and lit all the candles? I've known that women like to, when they take baths, they like to relax and they like to light candles. There's nothing unusual about any of this. But obviously, in my mind, she was probably being interrupted from her bath, went down, answered the door for one reason or the other. Again, unanswered questions. But again, she has no shoes on. All of these things are documented, photographed. We begin to look at things a little more closely. Meanwhile, there's a pager that continues to go off near the male victim. So we're building all of this evidence. Everybody's working. The media is building up across the way. At one point, we have these cameras zoning in on the victims. I said earlier, the victim, unfortunately, in these cases, is also evidence. The position the victim is evidence. Any blood formations, any blood streaks, anything on the blood in the form of blood trailing on the victim is evidence. The fact that the victim has jewelry on, or the lack of jewelry, is evidence. The fact the victim is, this one victim is barefooted, is evidence. Folding in the clothes is evidence. This is all evidence that could go to eliminate or inculpate any suspect that may be interviewed or a witness. You want this evidence protected that is now on the victim and the victim themselves. It's not something that you want to do, but under these conditions, with these high velocity cameras, they're all being set up. Nicole needed to be covered, and we didn't have tents or anything else. The male victim off to the side was protected from the cameras across the street. So I got one of the officers to go inside and say, get a clean sheet, blanket, or whatever you can, make sure it's clean. Bring it out, we're gonna place it over Nicole. You don't suggest to do this because there's always a possibility you're gonna leave evidence, fiber evidence, or anything else that'll have to be checked out later on and discarded as evidence, depending on what the blanket of the sheet is. So you wanna be careful putting something over a victim. But our choice is, we either put a blanket over this particular victim, or we leave ourselves open to all of this evidence being released to the world. The folds in the clothing, the jewelry, which the watch becomes an issue later, the blood trailing, the injuries of the victim is evidence. Had to make a decision, the decision is made. I want the evidence preserved. So this was questioned later, and it had nothing to do with nothing. It turns out it's a red herring, because it was able to protect all of that evidence and still use this sheet. Actually, it turned out to be a very tight woven hospital blanket that was used. That was the right call then. It's the right call today. I would do it again without even questioning. At this point, I'm notified by my partner that Simpson has landed and he's at Rockingham. He says, the media is all over us again, all over Rockingham. We're gonna take Simpson to the station, RHD, Robbery Homicide Division, my office downtown, where we need to interview him, and we need to interview him now. I hate to leave a crime scene under these circumstances. I had, again, no choice. I could stay there and say, well, he can wait another 6 or 8 hours while I continue with the crime scene investigation. I said, no, I'm not gonna do that. We need to talk to him now. Put someone else in charge of the crime scene at that point. I have a photographers working. I have late print people working. I have criminalists working. Once the criminalists are done with Bundy, they're going to roll over to Rockingham, because now we have essentially three crime scenes. You have Bundy, you have Rockingham, and you have the Bronco. We look further in the Bronco, and before I left, and in the back, I noticed a big shovel in plastic wrapping, and I'm thinking in the back, what is the shovel and wrapping doing in the back of this car? We run a DMV check on the car, and it's a Hertz car. Hertz, O.J. Simpson, they put two and two together. Obviously, this is a Hertz vehicle that they've given him to either use, or they let him do it for the advertising of the vehicle. I don't know. But we've got what appears to be a speck of blood on it. We've got this shovel and all this plastic tarp in the back. We want to get inside that vehicle and check it out thoroughly. That also is going to go on the search warrant. We've got all of these things working, so you have to prioritize. So right now, Simpson's back. He's going to talk. That's priority one. I returned to Robbery Homicide Division. Simpson is already there with two attorneys, Howard Weitzman and Skip Taft. Howard Weitzman is a well-known entertainment attorney. Skip Taft is more or less a family law type, civil litigant type attorney, but they're attorneys. They're here representing O.J. Simpson for whatever purposes. O.J. Simpson is not a suspect at this point, but he needs to be talked to. The sooner the better. Because of his wife, again, or she's a strange client, has been murdered. We get there, and I'm introduced to everybody. I'm introduced to Simpson, and I explain we would like to talk to your client. And Weitzman says, fine, can we talk to him first? I said, that's fine. Take all the time you want. So Weitzman and Skip Taft go with Simpson, and they sit down, and they talk for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And then he comes out, and he says, it's all yours. And it kind of struck me a little difficult, because the first thing I noticed when I was talking to Simpson, when I shook his hand, he used his right hand, but his left hand was bleeding. And I looked down, and still bleeding. He's kind of protecting it. So I'm thinking, again, those little things you put in the back of your head. Crime scene, left side, blood tailing, left side of a probable suspect with bloody footwear impressions. Left glove crime scene, right glove Rockingham. Doesn't mean he's a murder suspect. It means we're gonna have to spend some time with him, because now we have to ask him about that bleeding finger. Why wouldn't his attorney say something about that? It never came up. Apparently, maybe they didn't see it. I don't know. But now we're gonna spend some time with Simpson. We're gonna see what he's all about. Doesn't take long. Well, these two attorneys go to get a bite to eat, and they say, we'll be back. And they're like, fine. So we went inside the interrogation or interview room, whatever you want to call it. There's two types of situations that you can come up with here. You can interrogate someone, or you can interview them. If you're going to interrogate someone, you better have something to interrogate him with, and it's called evidence. There was no evidence, direct evidence of Simpson's involvement. We knew he was bleeding. Very interesting. Let's see what he says about the blood. Let's see what he says about what he did last night. This is interview. It didn't take but about 5 seconds to realize that O.J. Simpson's personality is very narcissistic. He's in charge. If he's not in charge, no game. You don't confront someone with no evidence, go good cop, bad cop, which is an interrogation, confronting them with evidence that you don't have if you don't have it. You let him speak. See what kind of inconsistencies we can get. But first, you have to advise him of his rights. Right away, that could put him off. We'll have to wait and see. So we sit down, and Phil explains to him, we're going to record the interview. And by the way, Weitzman mentioned to his credit, we want this any recording done. If you guys are going to talk to you, he said, fine, not a problem. We'll see you later type of thing. So Phil advises him of his rights. He agrees to that, and he says he understands his rights, and he will talk to us. The interview lasts 33 minutes. In the interview, he is very